You can get 3 months of The Spectator for just £15 and a free bottle of Pro Roger champagne if you go to spectator.co.uk/jingle. This offer is UK only and subject to availability.
Welcome to Holy Smoke, The Spectator's religion podcast. I'm Damien Thompson. See if you can guess the identity of the 20th century Scrooge, who had this to say about the public celebration of Christmas. It gives, on the whole, much more pain than pleasure. Anyone can force you to give him a present by sending you a quite unprovoked present of his own. It's almost blackmail. Who hasn't heard the wail of despair when, just as everyone hoped the nuisance was over for one more year, the unwanted gift from Mrs. Busy, whom we hardly remember, flops unwelcome through the letterbox and back to the dreadful shops one of us has to go? Things are given as presents which no mortal ever bought for himself, gaudy and useless gadgets. We're told that the whole dreary business must go on because it's good for trade. But can it really be my duty to buy and receive masses of junk every winter just to help shopkeepers? And then there's this. At my front door they are, once every year, the voices of the local choir, those of boys or children who haven't even tried to learn to sing or to memorise the words of the piece they're murdering. The instruments they play with real conviction are the doorbell and the knocker, and money is what they're after. Step forward C.S. Lewis, the beloved author of The Chronicles of Narnia, The Screwtape Letters, and Mere Christianity. Now, I should say immediately that Lewis was distinguishing between the solemn Christian feast of the Nativity, which was very important to him, and the commercial celebration of what he called Xmas. But I'm not sure that distinction would have meant very much to any poor carol singers who had the misfortune to ring his doorbell in Headington in Oxford on Christmas Eve. I'd originally thought that a Holy Smoke episode about C.S. Lewis and Christmas might be a rather seasonal feel-good experience, but Google soon disabused me of that. Yet, so far as I'm aware, nobody thinks that C.S. Lewis was naturally a mean-spirited man. His children's stories and Christian apologetics have brought spiritual comfort and entertainment to countless millions of people. So, to try and help me understand why Lewis wrote what he did, I'm delighted to be joined by Alistair McGrath, who's a world-renowned theologian specialising in the relationship between science and faith. He recently retired as a professor of science and religion at Oxford. He has a doctoral degree in molecular biophysics, and he's a world-renowned expert on C.S. Lewis. Indeed, it was Lewis who helped him discover Christianity while he was an undergraduate at Oxford University. I really enjoyed our conversation, which touched on many aspects of Christmas, and I hope you do too.
Professor Alistair McGrath, it's a huge pleasure, honour really, to have you as a guest on Holy Smoke. You're a very distinguished Christian apologist, probably the best known Christian apologist since C.S. Lewis, who did, I believe, play a very important part in your own conversion to Christianity from atheism when you were an undergraduate at Oxford.
Well, that's right. Lewis was really very interesting. I mean, he and I have a few things in common. We're both born in Belfast, both ended up at Oxford. So I began to read him when I was struggling with Christianity. I was a kind of Marxist back in the 1960s, like so many young people. And then began to really feel quite a few intellectual holes in this one and wanted something that actually was a big picture, that gave you this really satisfying, grander vision of who you were, what life was all about. And migrated towards Christianity, and it was wonderful, but there were lots of problems I could see. And then someone said, try reading C.S. Lewis, and I did. And basically, I am still reading him more than 50 years later. So I guess that says something about his ability to kind of keep his readers interested.
And was it his book, his collection of essays, Mere Christianity, that did the trick for you?
Well, I think those help. But the one that really interested me was a collection of essays called They Asked for a Paper. And there was one in it with the extraordinary title, Is Theology Poetry? And I read that one with interest. But actually, it was really setting out the intellectual credentials of Christianity and also saying, look, it has imaginative appeal. It doesn't just inform the mind. It stimulates the imagination as well. Christianity was rather more exciting than I'd thought. And secondly, this guy, C.S. Lewis, is really rather interesting. So I decided to stay with him. And indeed, that's what I've done.
And what were your first experiences of Christianity at Oxford? Was it attending College Chapel? You were at Wadham, weren't you?
That's right. I went to Wadham College Chapel. I did various things. I got to know an awful lot of Christians. I was surprised, I have to say, because I was a natural scientist at Oxford. And I'd been told that if you were a scientist, you couldn't be a Christian. And as I was a scientist, I was already bought into this way of thinking. But realizing that actually things were much more complicated, much more interesting, really was part of the reason why I began to think I'd prematurely closed down a very interesting discussion and wanted really to know more, like, for example, how my friends who were active natural scientists could hold together science and faith. And, well, they did. They did it rather well. And so that was a very interesting line of discussion I had.
And you were at Oxford, which was, of course, where C.S. Lewis spent most of his academic career. He was also at Cambridge, but I don't think he really felt at home in Cambridge. But he felt very much at home in Oxford. And he'd only been dead, I suppose, for about a decade by the time you were there. And, you know, this pub, the Eagle and Child, maybe the Lamb and Flag opposite, they're still associated with them. Could you almost feel the spirit of C.S. Lewis and of Tolkien hovering over Oxford in your day?
Well, you could, because it's very hard to walk around Oxford without coming across buildings or places where Tolkien or Lewis had been or had done something interesting. So there is a sense, although when I arrived at Oxford, actually, I hadn't really heard of C.S. Lewis very much. I knew he had written a book about wardrobes or something. That was about it. And also, I thought of him as being an English writer, whereas, of course, he was born in Belfast like me. But he was very, very interesting, I found. And you're quite right. I mean, it was very, very hard to walk around anywhere without coming across the traces of people of enormous stature, like, you know, philosophers, theologians, scientists. You know, it's just the whole place is just, if you like, an exhibit of memories of great voices from the past. And it's a very significant feeling walking around the place.
My initial thought about this episode was it would be nice to do something about C.S. Lewis at Christmas. And I had this vision of C.S. Lewis celebrating Christmas in Oxford, maybe in the Eagle and Child, maybe with snow. Oxford can be very, I have actually seen Oxford snowed under, perhaps not at Christmas, but in the winter. And so I had this rather cozy view of it. And then I was startled to read C.S. Lewis's thoughts on the celebration of Christmas. Well, as one might expect, his view of the importance of the incarnation and the importance of celebrating the incarnation is thoroughly orthodox and enthusiastic. But his view of the commercial celebration of Christmas, and I read out some quotes from his thoughts earlier, seems sour almost to the point of being mean-spirited, where he talks about who has not heard the wail of despair when at the last moment, just as everyone hoped that the nuisance was over for one more year, the unwanted gift from Mrs. Busy, whom we hardly remember, flops unwelcome through the letterbox and back to the dreadful shops one of us has to go. And he's even mean about carol singers, saying they, you know, they barely know, the boys barely know the hymns they're murdering and they're only interested in the money. And it all sounds rather jaundiced, though I did wonder if the fact that these things were written before his marriage, when he was perhaps a rather lonely bachelor, might have something to do with it.
Well, I think you're being very, very generous to him. I mean, he was a grumpy old man at times. And, you know, his views on the commercialization of Christmas do resemble Dickens's Christmas Carol, you know. Bah, humbug, it's all. And I can understand that, I think, actually. I think it's probably because Lewis can see there is something very significant which is being obscured or overlaid in a tawdry way by the way in which we celebrate Christmas. But I think I agree with you that Lewis is not the happiest commentator on the cultural celebration of Christmas. But when he starts writing about the deep significance of Christmas, you know, the whole idea of the incarnation, which you've talked about, you know, he really does actually begin to become much more interesting and actually almost warm in his reflections on it. So there are points at which I think Lewis does really point to some very good directions here.
I was reading something by the American writer Daniel DeWitt, who said, for Lewis, the incarnation was not something to be merely stamped on a card, drearily sung about in exchange for donations or symbolized in a well-balanced exchange of gifts. It was an event that was either true or false. If false, it meant nothing. If true, it changed everything. There could be no middle ground. The birth of Christ was a light illuminating the entirety of human history and one far too brilliant to be confined to a retail holiday. Which from his perspective, I suppose, is true. Though it seems a rather stark dilemma, I suppose, for modern people. For whom belief is not as black and white as it was for Lewis, to put it very crudely.
I think you're right there. I think Lewis perhaps is using polarization to try and emphasize his point. But I think there might be a slightly different way of looking at this. But I think there is something significant being said here. I think what Lewis is really saying is, if this Christmas story has the vitality and the trustworthiness that he believes it has, then frankly, it does change everything. And I know what he means. When I was an atheist myself many years ago, I mean, I could not see why anybody would want to believe in God, because God was up in heaven, wherever that was, and it made no difference to me at all on planet Earth. I think what Lewis is really trying to say is if Christmas is right, if this thing called the incarnation really happened, then actually God is not a distant absence, if I can put it like that, but rather someone who chose to enter into this world and transform it. So if you like, we're dealing with a very different understanding of God. I think what Lewis is really getting at here is that if you get the Christmas story right, it really does transform your understanding of the nature of life and also what does God is, what does God is like, and things like that. So I find him quite interesting here, although he at points Lewis does overstate to make points, but I think there is something nestling in the depths of what he's saying here.
You talk about him overstating things. Can I be honest with you? I've always found him, I enjoyed greatly the Screwtape Letters. I enjoyed as a boy The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe, though I lost patience with the sequence because the characters changed. Then I caught up with it again with The Last Battle. But there's one thing that C.S. Lewis said, which has always annoyed me immensely, and it's perhaps his most famous piece of apologetics, where he's talking about who Jesus was. And he says, either this man was and is the Son of God, or else a madman or something worse. And it's sometimes referred to as the liar, lunatic, Lord Lewis's trilemma. And I've always thought that the reasoning is so faulty, so obviously faulty, it doesn't allow for the possibility, and I'm not saying this is the case, it doesn't allow for the possibility that Jesus might have been a messianic rabbi, some of whose sayings in the Gospels are actually apocryphal. Even if you dismiss that, it doesn't. Lewis's trilemma doesn't allow for that possibility. And I've always thought, and I've heard it in the evangelical churches, I remember hearing it at Holy Trinity Brompton, I've always thought that a slightly facile argument. Passar, piece of Christian apologetics, and it rather put me off C.S. Lewis.
Well, it is not, in my view, one of Lewis's best arguments, if I can put it like that. I think that there are more than three options. I mean, there are several other we could add. I think what Lewis is probably trying to do is to arrest his readers, make them think about this. And perhaps he is making a fair point, which is that you can't just say Jesus is a good moral teacher, because if Christians are saying he's more than that, then really you have to try and understand what that is. But certainly, I think a number of scholars recently have just expressed anxiety about this. And if I had to point to a passage in C.S. Lewis where I myself said, I think that's just not up to your usual standard, I'm afraid that's probably one I would mention. So I think I do share your anxiety there. But I have to say also that there are some rather good passages where he says some wonderful things, not just in terms of their ideas, but in terms of the fluidity of his prose, which is really quite wonderful at times.
One of the problems with that Lewis trilemma is that it doesn't allow for the possibility that some of Jesus' sayings in the Gospels, particularly the fourth Gospel, may be apocryphal. I remember a very distinguished priest scholar at a mass I attended recently floated this possibility to a rather shocked congregation. But I wanted to ask you how the question of apocryphal stories relates to Christmas, because in the Gospels, the infancy narratives strain credulity in a way that perhaps the rest of the Gospels, particularly the synoptics, don't. It should be fairly obvious to most readers that the synoptics are based on eyewitness accounts, the degree to which they reinforce each other, have so much of them have the ring of truth. The infancy narratives read like, to many people, like myth. What's your take on that?
My take on it is that that there is indeed a different voice between the infancy narratives and the main trajectories of all the synoptic gospels. I think that is a fair point. It's quite clear that in drawing these gospels together, these writers have brought together a number of different accounts of what's happening and synthesized them into an overall whole. And my feeling is there's clearly something here that the gospel writers regard as being rooted in fact, but the voice is slightly different. But nevertheless, I think they do set context. I think one of the reasons why a lot of scholars are very interested in Mark's gospel is that it doesn't have infancy narratives. It really plunges you straight into the ministry of Jesus. And that's one of the reasons why I personally find that gospel very, very appealing, because you're confronted with this strange person immediately, and you're being forced to think, what's going on here? Who is he? What's he saying? What's the significance of this? Whereas the other Gospels, Luke and Matthew, do present more of the background to it. And there they're clearly drawing on different sources. So I think my own preference is for Mark's Gospel, because it is so coherent and brief, and everything is happening, you know, really focusing on Christ and not what happened before him.
And it's thought to be the earliest, isn't it? And it begins with a call to repentance, doesn't it?
I think that nobody's really quite sure exactly when it was written, but it has the feel of something very early. And I think that's one of the reasons why I personally find myself drawn to it, because it is simple. You know, it's a single authorial voice, and he drags me into his narrative, and really I stay with it because it's so interesting the way he's beginning to assemble this picture and bring out some very interesting points.
It surprised me when I realized many years ago, but I just really hadn't properly taken on board this point, that Paul's epistles predate the Gospels. It does put things in a rather different perspective, doesn't it? We're straying from the main subject now, but it is rather shocking to realize that Paul was writing to the Corinthians in AD 55, which is probably a couple of decades before the Gospels were assembled.
Well, I think that's right. And of course, we have to bear in mind that although you rightly say the Gospels were assembled, which I think is a very good way of putting it, the narratives were already in circulation. I mean, these were things that were in effect being repeated, being passed down, being passed over. So in effect, the formalization of these by gathering them together was later. But nevertheless, it's quite clear, for example, that when you read Paul, that Paul is echoing these gospel narratives, even though they haven't yet been written down in the form of gospels. He's aware of them. But you're quite right that Paul, for example, is really saying, look, here's what Christians believe, here's what Christians are meant to be living like. And he doesn't make all that many references to the historical ministry of Christ. His interest is much more, what does this person do to me? What difference does he make? In what sense does he give me an enlarged vision of reality, which enables me to go and live in a meaningful way? But of course, the gospels are quite important in that they begin to flesh this out and give you a sense of not simply the significance of Christ as a transforming agent, but actually what he might have been like as a person. I think that's just a very interesting point to make here.
Indeed. Well, coming back to Christmas, what nobody doubts is that, or shouldn't doubt anyway, is that Jesus of Nazareth was born and his birth had enormous significance for human history. I think perhaps almost anybody might describe the birth of Jesus Christ or Jesus of Nazareth or however you want to describe him as the most significant event in human history. Nonetheless, the celebration of it is difficult for many people. And it's difficult for believers as well as for non-believers, because the Feast of Christmas, about which Lewis writes in a rather complicated way, tries to break it down into different types of Christmas. But whichever sort of Christmas you're talking about, whether it's a purely religious celebration or whether it's the commercial side of Christmas, we associate it with childhood. We associate it with children. We all have vivid memories of childhood Christmases, not always happy ones, but usually, I think, happy and nostalgic ones. If, like me, you don't have children, the fact that the generations are not being replicated, the fact that you can't relive a childhood Christmas through your own children, and if you don't have many living relative to yourself, which is true of millions and millions of people. That can make Christmas, it's a bit of a cliche, people say it's a difficult time of year, but it is a difficult time of year. And the thought of, you know, attending midnight mass kind of fills me with horror, because there are so many ghosts of previous midnight masses and so many ghosts of people who aren't there anymore. And I think a lot of people feel that way. And I wonder if you're an Anglican priest yourself, I wonder what your message would be to them.
Well, I think I would want to begin by saying that I understand exactly what the problem is. I mean, if you like, Christmas here in the UK has become a bit like Thanksgiving in the States. It has a complex social function grafted onto what is basically a religious celebration. And very often, because this is a time when families will gather together, and of course, as you rightly say, they'll very often share memories of earlier Christmases. Do you remember, you know, great aunt so-and-so? And that can be difficult, because a lot of people will feel excluded by that. And I think that's a very important point to make. I think that my own uninteresting thoughts about this are really that I think this probably is inevitable. But nevertheless, I think what we can say is that it's helpful just to redirect ourselves to perhaps what for Christians is the primary point of Christmas. In other words, celebrating something that has happened, which actually brings a little bit of light into what's a very dark world, and actually seems to be getting darker all the time. I think that that is really quite important to remember. But alongside that, I mean, I think we could perhaps salvage something from perhaps this over social festival of Christmas and say Christmas is a very good time just to look back and look ahead and just take stock of things. I think all of us find it helpful at times just to look back, to remember friends we've had from the past, family and so on, and then begin to think how this might feed into the future. But my own feeling is that although in one sense I share your unease about the way in which Christmas has become a kind of celebration which does exclude some, I think that there is something there which really is worth remembering, that this is something significant. And if we didn't find some other way of celebrating families, I think we'd have to invent it. I think because, you know, finding some way of celebrating family, of gathering together for some specific reasons for families, is actually quite important socially. So it's a difficult balance, but I do take the point you're making.
And there is another aspect of Christmas which isn't confined to Orthodox Christianity, a positive aspect which this doesn't mention, which is a sort of folk belief or a theological belief that it's a season of forgiveness. And I think a lot of people hold that in their hearts, even if they're not churchgoers, don't they? It touches people who aren't necessarily believers.
I think that's very true. And, you know, you can think of so many movies which pick up on that theme. For example, Home Alone has a very strong theme of reconciliation. But I think it is an important point to say that while there's a sort of degree of sentimentalization of Christmas going on, actually there are some important points being made there. And you've just made what I think is perhaps the most important of those, which is that actually there's a sense that Christmas is a time where you try and make up, where you try and rebuild broken relationships or do something different. And the idea of trying to put right what has gone wrong is actually quite helpful, because it just reminds us that we all need these occasions when we have permission to say, oh, I'm sorry about that, or try and start again. And Christmas actually does have that celebration. And it has become really almost, if I can put it like this, part of the folklore of Christmas. This is the time for trying to rebuild bridges to people who you may have parted from, or you may have differences with. It's a time to try and set things right. In other words, yes, you're going to rejoice, but it wouldn't be even better if you could put things right before you rejoice.
Alistair, you're yourself an Anglican priest. May I ask how you're planning to spend Christmas? Will you be yourself celebrating a service?
No, I go to church now, and I very much enjoy being a passenger. What I mean by that is actually being able to sit and enjoy the liturgy rather than having to actually conduct the whole thing. It's a great privilege, I have to say, to be able to just sit and enjoy. And I feel a little bit guilty at times actually of doing that. But I think one of the things that keeps coming home to me as I you know, go to Christmas services is people have been doing this for a very, very long time. And it's this very strong sense of historical participation that actually this is something that's been around for a very long time. And in stepping into this remembrance of Christmas. Actually, I'm connecting up with what people have been doing for a very long time. And that sense of historical location, I think, is quite important, because very often, I think, we feel we don't really belong anywhere. And therefore, we find places or traditions where we feel we can be part of something that's deeper, that goes back a long, long way. And Christmas, I think, is a very important example of that. And I'm looking forward to feeling those thoughts again.
Will you be going to church in Oxford?
Near Oxford, where we live, yes. There's a great variety of possibilities there.
Right. Well, thank you so much for joining me. You have an important book, yet another important book, coming out next year, Why We Believe, Finding Meaning in Uncertain Times. It would be wonderful if you would come back and we could have a discussion about that. But in the meantime, may I wish you a very happy Christmas.
Which I reciprocate, and thank you very much for having me on this podcast. Thank you.